Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents So Much More by Kim Holden, narrated by Maxine Mitchell, Alex Kidd, and Elizabeth Hart. Prologue. Love explained or denied? Ask 100 people to explain love, and you'll get 100 different answers. Because love is like art. It's subjective. Fluid, ever-changing, evolving. Case in point. Miranda. Love isn't real. It's make-believe, like Santa Claus or Vegas. All sparkle and fluff until you look closely, and it's just a sham under the guise of over-inflated, wish-granting potential. Only fools believe in love. And I am no fool.
Seamus. Love is strange. It comes out of nowhere. There's no logic to it. It's not methodical. It's not scientific. It's pure emotion and passion. And emotion and passion can be dangerous because they fuel love and hate. I'm now a reluctant connoisseur of both, an expert through immersion. I know them intimately. When I fell in love with Miranda, it was swift and blind. We were both young. She was smart, beautiful, witty, and elusive. Rumors surrounded her like a legend that's repeated in hushed whispers for generations based on hearsay and speculation. People said she was cruel. I saw strong-willed. People said she was aloof. I saw independent. People said she was cunning. I saw goal-oriented. For every warning I was given, I put on rose-colored glasses and looked at her through my own warped but discriminating perspective. That is perhaps my biggest flaw, as well as my saving grace. I tend to only see the best in people. I had visions of grandeur. I didn't want to change her. I didn't think she needed changing. She was the person I'd elevated to mythical status in my head, in my dreams. Here's the thing about dreams. They're smoke. They're spun as thoughts until they become something we think we want, something we think we need. That was Miranda. She was smoke. I thought I wanted her. I thought I needed her. Over time, reality crept in and slowly dissected and disemboweled my dreams like a predator leaving behind a rotting carcass. Reality can be a fierce bitch. So can Miranda. And I can be a fool who believes in dreams and people and love.
Faith. There are a lot of things I've done without during my 22 years. You can't miss what you never had, right? That holds true for everything in my life, except one, love. I miss it, even though we've never met. It's not something I've idealized into unobtainable perfection. Humans are messy, and I'm sure love is too. I think love is instinct-driven, with the heart ruling over mind. It can't be defined. I'll just know it when I feel it. Because it will be so bone-jarringly beautiful. I want that someday. Bone-jarringly beautiful.
Get out of hell free card. Miranda. Past. You're such a bitch, Miranda, my roommate says with disdain. It's an insult. We're in the middle of one of our weekly, petty arguments. Our arguments are never over anything of significance. They're simply a product of our mutual dislike for each other. I roll my eyes, regretting that I have my back turned to her and she can't see the full force of my loathing. Like I haven't heard that one before, I retort, injecting the venom of the wasted eye roll into my words as I turn to face her. She yanks the strap of her backpack over her shoulder in true, pissy, self-righteous fashion and stomps to the door on her dainty little feet that are better suited for a fairy than a human. Her petite, ethereal appeal is one of the things that irks me the most about her. The other is that, deep down, she's just nice, which automatically means we repel each other like opposite sides of a magnet. I don't know what Seamus sees in you, she mutters, before slamming the front door behind her, eliminating my chance to reply. Me either, I whisper to an empty room. It's a truth I don't want anyone to hear. I've never been the type of girl who needed a man in her life. Men don't complete me. Romance is bullshit. They provide folly in my otherwise structured and strict world. I enjoy the occasional game of cat and mouse, at the conclusion of which I consume the mouse whole with sharpened teeth after toying with it until it's dazed into a bent version of its once vibrant self. Men are such simple creatures. The pretty ones are my favorite. Their egos so fun to crush into sparkly dust. Seamus is different, though. I didn't know it at first. When he pursued, I played coy and let him. It's all part of the game. But then we went out a few times, and that's when it happened. I was temporarily stunned, bewitched. Seamus is one of those rare men who has no clue how good-looking he is, how intelligent he is, how kind he is, how good he is. He just is. And oddly enough, I found that incredibly attractive. It's what drew me in. He's idealistic, selfless, and genuinely believes in the good in humanity. I didn't know men like him existed outside of the goddamn Hallmark Channel. It made me want to be like him. To be good. He's the only person I'd ever met who made me yearn for some light in my black soul. Foolish, I know. That pipe dream was short-lived. Thank God. I came to my senses and realized that idealism and goodness are a luxury afforded to few, and that kindness clashes with my life goals. Every last one. You can't claw your way to the top riding a wave of good intentions and hope for the best. Success is a science fueled by calculated action and hard work. It's manufactured, everything part of a larger agenda. People are pawns. Morals only get in the way. Power isn't granted to pussies. But here's the thing I've learned about having Seamus in my life. I need him. I need to keep him close. He's my get-out-of-hell-free card. My good karma card. My walking, talking, goddamn repentance. Being in a relationship with him is like living in a confessional booth. I sin, he absolves. It all evens out. I'm innocent by association. And goddamn, is he nice to look at. I was raised by my grandmother. She didn't have a lot of money. She was a lawyer who lived for pro bono work, passionately representing women who'd been wronged in some fashion or another. She shared her cases with me, and I learned early on that it's a dog-eat-dog world. Only the strong survive and thrive. She was vicious. My grandmother was the poster child for women's rights and the original man-hater. She hammered into me at an early age that I could do anything a man could do. Better. She was a brash, outspoken, unyielding, guiding force. The complete opposite of my doormat mother, a weak individual, compromised by vices and bad decisions that ended in her death when I was 10. She let others influence her and ultimately destroy her. I will not be my mother. I will be my grandmother. Nothing and no one will destroy me. My grandmother was someone people didn't simply cower from. They submitted. Willingly or not, they submitted. It never failed to awe me. The fact that she could inflict power over others so effortlessly and without remorse made her a goddess in my book. She chewed them up and spit them out. I grew up trying to emulate her. She was my role model. She pushed me in school. Nothing short of excellence and perfection was accepted, and instilled a work ethic second to none. Hard work was my ticket to everything I wanted. That, and a little subtle manipulation when necessary, another handy trick she taught me. She was the only person I craved approval from because she's the only person I admired. She died 2 days before I received my acceptance letter to UCLA. She never got to see our dream come true, attending a prestigious university and a coveted degree for me. I took that as a big fuck you from the universe. And ever since, I take every chance to give it the middle finger in return. But for some reason, Seamus is different. He feels like another fuck you, a cruel twist the universe is throwing at me to test my tough-as-nails resolve, which makes me love him and hate him at the same time. I want to cling to his soft heart, but I don't want his softness to seep into my hard heart, because softness will get me nowhere. And I have plans. Big plans. Everybody loves sheep. Miranda. Past. I bet you were the kid growing up who always had his name butchered by the teacher when they called roll the first day of school, I ask. He nods emphatically.
It still gets butchered, but yeah, let's just say the pronunciation of Seamus YouTube clip would have been helpful back then.
I eye him suspiciously. You're lying. There's a YouTube clip? He chuckles at my accusation.
Swear to God. Search it. There's a clip.
I make a mental note to do an internet search when I get home. Seamus McIntyre is an Irish name. I'm probing for history, lineage with that statement. He smiles that smile of his, the one that's effortlessly good-natured in intent.
It is.
The way he says it, I know he's gone down this road of ancestral interrogation before, not unjustified, because he's a walking contradiction. Shouldn't you have red hair, green eyes, and pale skin instead of all this? My outstretched hand motions wildly, showcasing him to illustrate my point. Your name is false advertising. He's the opposite of red hair, green eyes, and pale skin. He laughs before he says,
My dad's family was from Ireland a few generations back. My name was an attempt to reconnect to that, I guess. My mom was Hawaiian, born and raised. I look more like her, obviously.
The malice I hear in his voice when he speaks of his father flips upside down to reverence when he speaks of his mother. He's opened up a bit to me about his past. His father was an asshole and has been out of the picture, by his choice, since Seamus turned 18. His mother, on the other hand, from Seamus's stories, would have given Mother Teresa a run for her money. She died when he was a senior in high school.
Obviously,
I agree. He nods.
My middle name is Hawaiian, though. Auli. It means blue sky.
Sentimentality, something I'm unfamiliar with, oozes from him. It's fascinating. He's an ongoing experiment. Questions and answers like this only add to the pro column. Yes, I'm mentally keeping track of pros and cons. I have plans for an extraordinary life. Seamus is unique in almost all areas. A priceless piece of beauty. And that fits well amongst the extraordinary I'm building. He's a look-what-I-have-and-you-don't kind of specimen. We've been dating for months now. He's the only man I've ever met who can hold my attention. And vice versa. I'm clearly holding his. I usually get bored. They usually get intimidated. Blah, blah. But with him, there's an odd pull that I can't walk away from. It's as if the universe has administered a biting, backhanded slap to my face, warning me to open my eyes while screaming, It doesn't get any better than the man in front of you. Don't be a goddamn idiot. My life has been orchestrated in my mind for years. A strict timeline, complete with deadlines for success in all areas.
career, most importantly, and the picture-perfect facade that surrounds it. I've decided that Seamus needs to be a permanent fixture in my life. I need him to chase away the bad mojo I'm no doubt going to create. It's not my conscience I'm worried about. I, like my grandmother before me, am not equipped with one. It's my future facade. An enviable husband and a few spawn look good for well-rounded appearances' sake. A wolf surrounded by cute, likable, soft little sheep. Everyone loves sheep. So, I've stopped taking my birth control pills. Seamus doesn't know. We've talked about marriage and children. I break out in hives while he looks so contented with the idea, I would swear he was put on Earth solely for the purpose of procreation and his loins carry only angelic seed. Cue the commencement of shuddering. If I get pregnant, he'll marry me. And even when I can't pretend to be the Miranda he wants me to be and the real me shines through eventually, he'll never leave us. A baby is my guarantee. The world I'm creating for me. Miranda. Past. I love you. His words are haunting in the dark, spoken as his lips make repeated contact with my shoulder, my neck, painting promises and devotion. I'm greedy and love hearing it. It's affirmation he's mine. All mine. Compliant to me in matters of the heart. Willing, emotional servitude is like a drug, heady and boosting. I don't love the idea of mutual love, but I sure love the idea of being loved. It's powerful, because those who love are easily coerced. Seamus is lying behind me. We're naked, coiled in the midst of intimacy. He excels at it. I tolerate it. I do what I need to do physically to keep the emotional free flow on his end perpetual. Kissing, touching, penetration. He's skilled at translating what he feels into action. I'm skilled at faking it. That's it, Seamus. Like that. I sigh as he enters me. The sigh was a token for him. I should enjoy this, I think, as he eases in and out. He's a massive, potent man who always handles me with care and affection. His arms are wrapped around me, one hand masterfully stimulating from the front, while the other pays close attention to the rest of my torso. His lips worship every inch of skin within reach. This will go on for a while. We'll exchange words. We'll probably change positions. Orgasms will be achieved, mine included. But here's the thing. I don't enjoy sex. Never have. It feels submissive. The physicality of it seems unnecessary when my vibrator can achieve the exact same goal and in a fraction of the time. I'm too selfish to dole out pleasure to others, which, given the man I'm with, would be nothing short of sacrilege in most women's minds. Seamus is endowed beyond belief. Passionate, attentive, romantic, and gorgeous. I'm fully aware that I'm wasting his resources with my lack of appreciation. I've seen the way women prowl him with their eyes, fantasies of role-playing the goddamn Kama Sutra written all over their horny, needy expressions. My lust is for power. And that's where sex comes in. Fucking is merely a means to an end for me. A power play. I've always taken this approach. My vagina is a weapon in my arsenal, and any stiff cock can be defeated by it. Weakened. Vanquished. It's a tool to conquer. And speaking of conquering, I win. Though my uterus objects vehemently to that statement. I'm pregnant. And I have a ring on my left hand. And though I'd love to gloat and celebrate my victory in raucous fashion, I'm biding my time, quietly letting Seamus bask in the world I'm creating for me. Yes, me. There's no we. He can have the kid. I just need the facade.
Third time's the charm. Seamus. Present. Divorce. A severing of sacred ties. The end of a dream. The death of a family. This word defines me. The first time she asked me for a divorce was at the end of our first date. She was joking and followed it up with our first kiss. The second time she asked me for a divorce was when she was in labor with our second child, a labor that, due to its rapid emergence, disallowed the administration of pain-dulling drugs. She also told me she hated me, cursed my penis's existence, and said my sperm were the devil's work. I think it was the pain talking. The third time she asked me for a divorce, she meant it. Third time's a charm. This divorce is all I think about. I dwell on it. It rules my thoughts, especially on a day like today. The kids and I are moving into our apartment, minus Miranda. Because divorce. How can a word so benign become uglier every time I turn it over in my head? It's just a word. Seven little letters. Letters that should be harmless. But those seven letters have ganged up on me, and every time I think about them, it feels like an attack. An attack on my heart. An attack on my children. An attack on my pride. An attack that's muddied my soul. Thank God for my kids. They're my life. They're my purpose. They're my everything. Daddy, hurry up. I gotta pee. It's the pained, I'm not lying whine of a little girl in dire need of a bathroom. My 5-year-old Kira is standing at the top of the flight of stairs with her legs crossed, holding her brother's hand. She looks so much like her mother. Curly, caramel-colored hair, almond-shaped eyes, the color of the sky on a stormy day, and lips that form the shape of a heart when they're resting one atop the other. I'm coming, darling. The walk upstairs is slow. My legs don't work like they should, especially when I'm carrying a heavy box. Throw me the keys, Dad. I'll get her inside. Kai to the rescue. Again, he's always been incredibly mature, but his mother leaving has aged him. A boy of 11 shouldn't be expected to fill the parental void. He does, though. He never complains about it. Maybe he saw our marriage falling apart before we did. Certainly before I did. We were never perfect, but I didn't suspect the affair. I was in shock when the papers were served. I was in denial during the entire court proceeding, and I still half expected her to be there when I came home, weeks after she moved to Seattle to be with him. Him. My downfall. The man who not only stole my wife, but who stole my kid's mom. Did that sound bitter? Yes. Good, 'cause I am. I serve up my bitter with a heaping side of bitter. I set the box down on the 4th or 5th step and dig in my pocket for the apartment keys and toss it up to him. Apartment 3, our new home. The throw's too hard and it hits the door behind him with a tink and falls to the ground next to his feet. As he picks it up, I hear him whisper to his sister, "Come on, Kira, race you inside." She giggles and her feet start bouncing off the pavement as if she's warming up for a sprint. I can't help but smile at these two. As I pick up the box again, I look at the front windows of the apartments just below ours, apartment 1 and 2. The curtains are drawn on both. For a moment, I wonder who's inside. Families? Maybe there are kids for my kids to play with living there. The thought disappears as my toe catches the front edge of the stair 3 from the top. It's not a violent, painful fall because the box I'm carrying breaks it for the most part. I'm embarrassed more than anything. The fact that my legs don't always cooperate is embarrassing. I glance behind me, down the stairs to the sidewalk and parking spaces below. No witnesses. The realization brings with it relief I didn't know I needed. My heartbeat begins to slow, and I let out the breath I was holding. A strained breath that attempts to grasp at straws, better known as dignity. Maybe I should have looked for a first floor apartment, but my stubborn side wouldn't allow me to consider it. As I stand, riding the box with both hands, Kai comes out. "You need some help with that box, Dad, or should I just grab the other one from the car?" "I've got this one. Why don't you grab the other one, buddy? And see if you can coax Rory out of the car," I ask Kai, brushing off my current exasperation. Rory is my 9-year-old. He's not happy about our move. Or with his mom, and he's not shy about letting her know. He scornfully addresses her as Miranda. Kai loops down the stairs, taking them 2 at a time. He's tall for his age at 5'5" and athletic. He's pretty much a mirror image of me when I was 11. A carbon genetic copy with dark hair and eyes, golden brown skin, wide-set shoulders, and long, gangly limbs. When I walk into the apartment, Kira is perched on the arm of the couch. Her stuffed cat, Pickles, is in one hand and the TV remote is in the other. She's flipping through channels at breakneck speed. "Can I help you with anything, Kira?" She responds without taking her eyes off of the screen, flashing images.
"No, Daddy, I've got it all under control."
I smile and shake my head, realizing she's heard me say that one too many times if she's worked it into her vernacular. When I say it, it's mental coaching to prompt self-assurance. When she says it, it's confidence. I love her confidence.
"Knock, knock,"
a sing-song voice calls from the landing outside the open door. I set the box I'm carrying on the couch next to Kira and turn to see our landlady, Mrs. Lipikowski, standing on the worn, faded welcome mat. All of the letters are worn away, except the W and E that bookend the word. The mat, like everything else in the furnished apartment, is old and worn. I'm not complaining. There's character and an almost identifiable, charming essence encapsulated in this time capsule my family will call home for the next year. Mrs. Lipikowski and her husband have owned this small brick building since it was built in 1972. It houses a deli that they run, two tiny apartments on the first floor and two larger apartments on the second floor, one of which the Lipikowskis live in. It's three blocks from the beach and two blocks from John F. Kennedy High School, where I'm a counselor. The location is ideal. "Hey, Mrs. L., it's good to see you. Come on in." She walks in and immediately takes my hands in both of hers. It's a motherly, friendly gesture. She does it every time I see her, which is most every day since I survive on her deli sandwiches during the week for lunch.
"I see you're getting settled in, Seamus. Anything you need?"
I glance around absently, not really looking for anything in particular.
"No, I think we're good. Thank you."
She pats the top of my hand with hers, which draws my attention back, and my eyes land on her Janis Joplin tie-dye t-shirt. She wears tie-dye every day in some fashion or another. Shirts, pants, skirts, shorts, scarves, you name it, she owns it in tie-dye. She's a hardcore hippie. I don't think she's changed her wardrobe or her lifestyle since the 60s. Some would call her dated. I call her authentic. She is who she is, and she owns it. And I love that about her. Authentically rare. Either people don't know who they are, or they're afraid to share themselves with the world. I myself fall into both of those categories. I don't know. And I'm afraid. I wasn't this way before, and I'm not happy about it. Life has beat me down. I fought for a long time, but after the divorce, I woke up one day and couldn't remember the man I used to be. Only that time and circumstances have changed me. I need to find me again.
"Stop by our apartment tonight and I'll brew you a cup of my herbal tea. It helps calm the nerves."
She winks and smiles warmly, and I wonder for a moment what type of herbs are in her tea. "Okay," I answer.
"Just pop in the deli if you have any questions about the move-in or your apartment,"
she looks at my daughter and says.
"And you come down later and I'll give you some pickles, Kira."
Kira's ears perk up at the mention of her name and pickles in the same sentence. Pickles are her favorite thing, followed closely by television and cats.
"Five slices?" she asks excitedly.
Mrs. L nods.
"Five pickle slices for the five-year-old."
Kira stands on the couch and throws her hands up in the air over her head in an act of jubilant celebration, the remote and Pickles the cat still clutched in her arms.
"Yay!" "Well, hello, boys."
Mrs. L's greeting pulls me back to the front door, where Kai walks in carrying a box with Rory trailing closely behind.
"Hello, Mrs. Lipikowski," Kai says politely.
"Hiya, Mrs. Lipikowski,"
Rory says in a flawless British accent. He discovered Harry Potter movies and Doctor Who a month ago. His obsession with all things British was instantaneous. The accent was adopted immediately, and he hasn't deviated from it for weeks. It's gone from a quasi-Australian-British confused hybrid to sounding like a Sherlock Holmes doppelganger in an impressively short amount of time. I find myself forgetting my little boy is indeed not Benedict Cumberbatch when I listen to him. Mrs. L smiles at me approvingly.
"You've done well with this lot, Seamus. Strong personalities, each and every one."
She doesn't have children, but The way she looks at them makes me feel like that was a choice made by the fickle hand of fate, not by her and her husband. Thank you. I smile inwardly at the compliment.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?